PCJ Radio International presents the longest-running international show, The Happy Station Show, produced and presented by Keith Pehon.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome again to another edition of your program, Happy Station, from PCJ Radio International. It's always nice, of course, to have you with us. This is the first show for the month of August. And since it is the first show of the month of August, as you're probably aware by now, every year at this time, I sort of vanish. That's right, I head off somewhere, usually around the 4th of August every year. So today's show is going to be different. As I was going through the archives and thinking, what should we use today? Because there was so much preparing to do before I went away, because I had to pre-record 2 weeks of programs, not just Happy Station, but other things as well. I decided to go into the archives and pull up an interview, one of the earliest interviews that we did on the show, that I think many of you will enjoy hearing again. So before we get to that, let's take a listen to a little bit of music. Here's Alanis Morissette and Hands Clean.
If it weren't for your maturity, none of this would have happened. If you weren't so wise beyond your years, I would have been able to control myself. If it weren't for my attention, you wouldn't have been successful. And if it weren't for me, you would never have amounted to very much.
Hands clean. Alanis Morissette beginning today's edition of Happy Station. And nice song. Always enjoyed that song. Now, I said to you just a few moments ago that I am away, so we're doing sort of a best of today. I decided to go back into the archives and dig up an interview that we've only ever aired once before. And a number of you have suggested over the last couple of years that we run it again. It's of the interview's with a woman who was part of the British pop scene in the 1970s. She's still performing today, but she's performing a very different style of music. I'm talking about the one and only Helen Shapiro, that had a string of hits in the 1960s, just around the time of the Beatles. She even performed with the Beatles on TV shows and in live performances. So on today's edition of Happy Station, we bring you again Helen Shapiro.
Well, just because I'm in my teens and I still go to school, don't think that I dream childish dreams. I'm nobody's fool. Don't mother me. That makes me wild. And please don't treat me like a child. It's often said that a youngster should be seen and not be heard. But I want you to realize that is quite absurd. Don't wanna be so meek and mild. So please don't treat me like a child.
I have so many things that I want to ask. I mean, you started in the music industry at a very young age. I believe you were 14 when you recorded your first single.
That's right, I was. It was called Don't Treat Me Like a Child, and frankly, it was a cry from the heart.
Now, let me ask you, because you started at 14, and you were recording at Columbia with people such as Nori Paramore, who at the time was recording with everybody from Cliff Richard, Frank Ifield, Adam Faith, and anybody else who was, you know, passing through the studio. What was that like? Because, I mean, Nori was much older than all of you at the time.
Yeah, that's true. He was like a father figure to us, actually. But in those days, that's how the situation was. Columbia Records in this country was one of the labels that came under the EMI banner, and Nori was one of several house producers, along with people like George Martin, mm-hmm. And so forth. Nori was a big name in his own right, actually, as a musician, as a conductor and arranger and a songwriter. So it was a great privilege, actually, to have him guiding my recording career.
You know, a friend of mine who also was in the same label, which you met many years ago, Frank Ifield, He was telling me some funny stories, and he says he remembers the funniest one when he first showed up in the UK to record at Columbia. You said before they went to the studio, they were in an office, they were rehearsing the number that they were going to do. They walked to the studio, there was the full orchestra, there was some technicians in the control room wearing white lab coats, smoking cigarettes, looking like doctors more than anything. Nori walks in, went to the podium and said, okay, we're going to make a take. And then he said, off in the corner were these four women drinking tea, probably doing some crochet. They got up, they did the back vocals. As soon as the session was done, they sat back down, drinking tea, and continued with their crochet work.
Well, yeah, that's a pretty good picture of how it was in those days, I have to say. I think maybe the technicians might have discarded the white coats by the time I got into the studio in early 61. But it was like that, yeah. And you recorded live. The band was there in the studios. The singers were there. I think Frank would have been referring to the Mike Sams singers, who also sang on my records. And yeah, it was like that. You'd sit in the studio with a cup of tea and you got up and sang because everybody read music and they had the music parts in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you did a take, and if it didn't work, you started again, you did another take. And it was all done like on two tracks or four tracks, unlike the way it is today. Actually, when I look back and think of what we used to do, it's pretty scary, but we didn't know any different. But there was a good live sound, you know, to those early records.
What I found quite amazing was the fact that back then, because the musician unions, the singer had to perform live with the orchestra, and that if you wanted to do a voice take, you kind of had to do it in secret almost.
That's absolutely right. Whereas on the continent, because I did records in Germany and France, you were allowed to put the voice on afterwards. Frankly, though, I have to say it was much better singing live with the band. It had a feel to it, which you could lose in those days. Because when I recorded in Germany and France, I'd put the voice on. They always had the voice right up the front, and they had the musicians sounding like they were 2 miles away. So it lost something, I think.
What was it like back then? I mean, you were working and traveling around the UK with people like Frank Ifield, Cliff Richard, and Adam Faith, and you were like the youngest one in the group. What was that like?
Well, my first year in the business, I was actually still at school, so I was very limited by law in what I could do. So I was allowed to just do the occasional radio program or TV show and do the odd concert in the school holidays and things like that. Once I left school at the end of 1961, having already had my first three hit records, it was a question of going on the road, a whole bunch of different performers piling into a coach and just traveling around the country, doing concerts in cinemas and town halls and things like that. I loved it. I never actually went on the road with Cliff or Frank or Adam. By that time, it was my own show, and we had other different people on the show. And I loved every minute of it. It was such a thrill. I mean, because I was a kid. I was only 15 by the time I went out on the road. And one of the tours I did, we had the Beatles on the show. They were one of the opening acts.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like 21 years old. I was 16. That was in early 63. But I just enjoyed every minute of it. I couldn't wait for the next tour. We did one tour after another in those days. I loved it.
Do you look back at that now and say to yourself, I can't believe I did that?
Yeah, frankly. Yes, I mean, I couldn't do all of that I did then. I mean, obviously, when you're young, you have the energy, you have the excitement. You have a brashness and a confidence that gradually fades as you get older, just as you obviously you gain experience and you realize the pitfalls. But when you're young, you can do anything. I'm glad I did it. I wouldn't like to do it again.
That's what Frank had told me on a number of occasions. He said, you know, back then he said I could do anything, but he said now when I think about that, it just even thinking about it makes me tired.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with him entirely.
Well, here's something, because back then, of course, unlike today, the record company really had a lot of control over the songs that many of the singers were doing. And the John Lennon and Paul McCartney even wrote a song for you called Misery, but you didn't turn it down.
No, I didn't. It was turned down by Norrie Paramore on my behalf without, before I even knew that it existed. The first day that I met the Beatles when we were starting on the tour, they told me, we submitted a song that we'd written for you, which, because I was going to Nashville at that time to record an album. I think they may have thought it was for that. And they said Norrie turned it down. So it was a fait accompli. So, but never mind. Somebody else recorded it after that.
But the thing is, when this kind of thing would happen, I mean, not just with you, but with other singers, would all of you kind of gather around and say, you know, I wish that they hadn't turned it down because I would have liked to have recorded it?
Well, I think at the time I thought that, but I didn't dwell on it too much. I was just having too much fun. at that time, I was, like I say, I was about to go to Nashville to do a record. I was doing all kinds of tours in other countries as well as in this country. I loved the Beatles. I enjoyed working with them, watching them on stage, and watching them grow and develop as a band. So it wasn't something that, you know, niggled me too much. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't even know if the song would have really suited me.
What should I write? What can I say? How can I tell you how much I miss you? No weather here has been as nice as it can be. Although it doesn't really matter much to me. Everybody loves the summertime. But you know, darling, while your arms are out of reach, the summer isn't any friend of mine. It doesn't matter whether skies are gray or blue. It's raining.
It might as well rain until September here on the Happy Station, and that was Helen Shapiro. And Helen Shapiro is my special guest on this edition of the show. Now, you just mentioned that you went off to Nashville to record an album.
Yeah.
Was that something that was obviously something that the record label had wanted to do, correct?
Well, yeah. They said, look, you can do an album in America. We'd like you to do that. You can choose New York or Nashville. And for some reason, I chose Nashville. I think I would choose New York now.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, Nashville was not because, I mean, I'm not a country music singer. But Nashville was like famous for Elvis Presley, the Everly Brothers, Brenda Lee, you know, and there was some good stuff coming out of there. So I said, let's do it in Nashville. And it was a fantastic experience. Again, it was totally different from doing a recording in this country, because in this country at EMI, even though you sang there with the band in the studio, you were sort of tucked away behind a sort of a glass, I don't know what to call it, like a cage. Whereas in Nashville, it was just in this big room, and I was standing there in the middle of the room surrounded by musicians, and they were kind of making it up as they went along. It was just so wonderful, the atmosphere.
So it sounds a lot more relaxing than working at Abbey Road Studios.
It was, actually. It was great. I wish all my recordings could have been done that way. We were happy with the album. We released a couple of tracks from it when we came back. So mm-hmm. It was a good thing.
So, I mean, when you started off at 14, it sounds like you were heavily influenced by, let's say, singers like Brenda Lee and also Alma Cogan. How much of listening to their music did that have an impact on you?
Well, I wasn't really influenced by Brenda Lee or Alma Cogan. My influences were Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and Peggy Lee and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was brought up with jazz as my sort of basic first choice in music. So I listened, well, I didn't, as far as listening to any of this stuff, we didn't have a record player. We just listened to things as they came up on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother, he got into that kind of music before I did, and so he was a big influence on me for that.
Now, when you were first getting ready to record, because of your voice, I mean, it sounds more popular jazz and popular standards more than say rock and roll at the time. Did they ever think of maybe putting you in that direction?
Well, that was what I wanted to do. My ambition from a child was to be a jazz singer. I used to sing when I was a kid with my brother's jazz band at our youth club and that kind of thing. It wasn't anything they particularly. In fact, they were the ones who were pushing me into the pop side,
mm-hmm.
for which I was very grateful. I mean, I liked pop music, and I liked all the pop singers of the day, but my ultimate thing was that I wanted to sing jazz and blues. In fact, I did an EP when I was, I think, still 15, called A Teenager Sings the Blues, and I would include things on that and on a couple of LPs, things like, you know, the real old-fashioned blues things like St. Louis Blues, Basin Street, Blues in the Night.
Mm-hmm.
And Norrie wrote a song called A Teenager Sings the Blues. So I was that was my influence coming in very early. And indeed, just before that, I think, we did an EP called Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which got into the singles charts, which contained Goody Goody, Birth of the Blues, Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which wasn't my choice, and another song which I can't remember.
But,
so it was always there.
But Tiptoe Through the Tulips, you didn't obviously sound like Tiny Tim.
No, thank the Lord. No, that came out much later. This was before that.
Right.
You know.
Got the St. Louis blues. I'm just as blue as I can be. Well, that man's got a heart like a rock cast in the sea. Or else he wouldn't go so far from me. I hate to see that evening sun go down. Yes, I hate to see that old evening sun go down. Because my just like I feel today. Yes, if I feel tomorrow like I feel today,
You know, there was also, you were also doing a lot of television work at that time on Ready, Steady, Go. And a few months ago, I'd interviewed a cameraman who used to work on that show when it was on from 63 to 66 on Ready Fusion. And yeah. I asked him for a funny anecdote, and he said he remembers one time, he said he doesn't remember who he was shooting singing. It was either Billy Fury or Adam Faith. But the director kept yelling in his headset saying, "There's something wrong with your camera." It kept going to black and then was being normal, and then it kept going to black. And the stage director and him realized that you were actually standing in front of the camera and your hairdo was getting in the way.
Me? Oh, wow.
And, you know, that, which leads me to the thing about, you know, the hair, because would you say that was a trademark of yours back then?
I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, looking back, yeah, because I get people coming up to me now, like women, say, "Oh, I used to have the Helen Shapiro hairdo or hairstyle," and I didn't even know that it was a thing, you know, because to me, everyone had big hair in those days, and I wasn't a trendsetter. I never saw myself as that. I was just following what had gone before, but apparently it kind of stuck, which is fine. I'm happy with that.
How much work must have gone into that every time?
Oh, tons. You know, for me, getting ready each day, especially if I had a TV program or a concert to do, I'd be sitting there for an hour with the makeup and the hair and the whole thing. I mean, that's what we did in those days, with the back combing and the hairspray and the whole thing. That was life. That was part of life.
What was it like working on Ready, Steady, Go? Because something that people who may have not seen the show was that everybody lip-synced to songs.
Oh, lip-syncing.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, we say miming. That's what we did in those days. I mean, actually, before Ready, Steady, Go, the big program was a thing called Thank Your Lucky Stars, which ran for many years, and the first TV I ever did was that. And you did. You mimed to your records. I mean, frankly, it made it a lot easier. And obviously, it was later on that people started doing live stuff. People just wanted the sound, because in those days, frankly, the TV studio sound systems and that weren't that great, and they couldn't reproduce the sound on the record, so it was just as easy for us to stand up and lip sync.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, doing Ready, Set, Go, that must have been a blast, because it was at a time when the audience, when you know, there was a live audience, but everybody was so close to the performers, it must have been so cramped, because you look, when I see the series now, that does not look like a big studio.
No, it wasn't, come to think of it. I think there was a sort of a balcony area where people could be upstairs and dancing and looking over, as well as what was on the floor. But, you know, we didn't know any different. For us, this was great, because, like, Thank You Lucky Stars, the other one before, was just in a bare studio with some rather strange-looking settings behind us. But it was great to be among the kids. You know, they loved it, and nobody caused any trouble, at least the ones I did. It gave a great atmosphere. You know, and this was in the days before Top of the Pops, which kind of, you know, took over from that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good show.
So when you did Ready, Set, Go, which was live, was there much rehearsing involved?
Yeah, I remember the one I did where I sang to the Beatles.
Look Who It Is.
Pardon?
You did the song Look Who It Is.
That's right. I think we ran it two or three times. The idea, they said, you know, the idea was I was just going to be going on and singing this song. And they said, listen, we've had this thought. Would you mind singing it to the Beatles? I said, nah, it'd be great. And because there were only three kind of verses, there was a middle and then a middle section, they would only use three of the boys. So, you know, it took a while just to rehearse the camera shots, because there's me walking up and down there mm-hmm. with them, and they wanted to make sure it was right. But frankly, probably much less rehearsal than they would take today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, today they'd be able to use computers and whatever else. But it was a fun time, that.
Do you enjoy working in television?
Yeah, I do. I've done very little television, I must say, compared to most other singers. For instance, you know, even though I had those records and all that going for me, I never had my own show, even a one-off, let alone a series. I often guested on people's shows, but not an enormous amount. But I do enjoy. I enjoyed television, particularly when there's an audience.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I enjoy and enjoyed most of all was just live concerts, live shows. That was always the best thing.
Let's now take a listen to Helen with a song that she sang to the Beatles on Ready, Steady, Go all those many years ago. Look Who It Is, here on The Happy Station.
Look who it is. Look who it is.
Well, look who it is. Fancy meeting you suddenly. Well, look who it is. I can see you remember me. Yes, I'm the one who believed. I just didn't need you. Look.
Look Who It Is, Helen Shapiro here on the Happy Station Show. And if you've just tuned in and wondering, wait a second, what's going on? Well, my special guest for this 55 minutes is the legendary British singer Helen Shapiro. Yesterday I was watching a video of when This Is Your Life surprised you. And you got out of the car, and you were going to be, you know, looked like you were going to record something else, and all of a sudden, This Is Your Life.
I tell you, I'll never forget it. I was quite traumatized by it. I mean, it was a great honor and everything, but I would never want to go through something like that again. I really thought, I had been told that I was going to be coming along to do take part in a tribute show to Humphrey Littleton.
Right.
Of Humphrey Littleton and his band, who I sang with for many years. And so I totally, totally did not know anything. People say, oh, you knew. I didn't know. And so getting out of that car, and there's Humphrey and his band playing Walking Back to Happiness outside the studios, and there's all these people standing around and cameras, and it still didn't click until Michael Aspel came round from nowhere with his book, and there was such a shock. I felt like I was being undressed in front of the whole world, you know? It was just, and they edited it. I actually couldn't speak for about 10, 15 seconds, which for me is quite a feat.
After that, did you have a conversation with your husband saying, what did you do?
Well, kind of, sort of, yeah. I beat him up, actually. No, it was all him. He did all that. I mean, and he told me later all about it and how difficult it was to arrange and to keep it from me. But he did a great job. And it was lovely seeing everybody and going through it. But there was a kind of an unreal feeling about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I'd say it was an honor. And I'm very glad that they thought to do it for me. But had I had the choice beforehand, I would have said, no, please, no thanks.
Well, yeah. for the past couple of years, you've been heavily involved with gospel outreach.
Yeah.
How did that start?
Well, actually, I've been involved with my gospel evenings and outreaches since 1990. In 1987, I made the most amazing discovery that Jesus was the Messiah promised to Israel. I'm Jewish, and that Jesus is the Messiah, after all, having read the messianic prophecies in the Old Testament and seeing their fulfillment in the New. And I made a commitment to him in 1987. And as a sort of an outworking of that, I began to put some songs together and do... They started off as concerts, just full concerts with the band and everything, in which I'd give my story. But I toned those down a little bit. They stopped being concerts, and just me standing up there telling about how I came to my faith,
mm-hmm.
And interspersed with some songs and giving the gospel message. And basically in various different forms, that's how it's been right up to this day. I would intersperse these evenings in and out, you know, in between my actual pop and jazz concerts, which I was doing many of. But I actually came out of the music business at the end of 2002 to concentrate full time on my gospel outreach evenings. And I love them, and I'm very busy doing those to this very day.
With the gospel outreach evenings that you do,
yeah.
Do people go to your show and sometimes ask you to sing some of your old hits?
Now, sometimes people say, oh, I thought you might have sung some of your old hits. In fact, I do sing Walking Back to Happiness
mm-hmm.
on that. I mean, what happens is, at the very beginning, a colleague of mine who plays guitar, we get up and we sing a few songs, and we get the audience joining in. These are spiritual songs, you know, biblical things, usually with a Hebraic feel to them,
mm-hmm.
Because that's the kind of music I tend to do. And then interspersed, like I say, within the talk that I give, are some other songs which I sing with backing tracks, songs that I've recorded in my gospel albums. But like I say, I do sing Walking Back to Happiness, and we're very, very clear to emphasize the fact that this is not a concert. You know, this is on the posters and on the leaflets and the advertising. This is a gospel outreach, so that anybody who comes knows they're not in for a concert. And then, you know, when I finish my bit on the platform, I then spend time talking to people. They come and talk to me for an hour, even 2 hours afterwards, and I love that.
How do you choose songs for the gospel outreach?
Well, there are only actually 5 songs that I sing with the backing tracks, and say another 5 with my colleague. That's a good question. I don't know how to answer it, really. It just kind of developed over the years. They tend to be, I suppose, they tend to be in keeping with what I'm speaking about. And so that's really how it's been down through the years.
Enter into his courts with praise. Enter into his gates with thanksgiving. Enter into his courts with praise. Rejoice and be glad in thy Creator. Rejoice and be glad in the Father of lights. Rejoice and be glad in thy salvation. Rejoice and be glad in the Ancient of
Rejoice and be glad in the
Yes, the one and only Helen Shapiro here on your program, Happy Station. Hope you enjoy that. And I know that a number of you are familiar with interviews that we've done over the last, well, since 2009. And if there is an interview that you would like to hear again, or a guest that you would like to suggest for the program, let us know. Our email address is hs@pcjmedia.com. That's hs@pcjmedia.com. And of course, we'd always love to hear from you. Now, what was the next thing that I wanted to get to? Well, it's not really important right now, so I'll sort of skip it, only because I can't remember what it is. If you want to hear this program again, as well as past editions of the program, I invite you to check out our website, www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com. You can catch another edition of this program targeting listeners in Southeast and East Asia on 11835 kilohertz Sundays at 1330 UTC. Now, I want to mention one thing before we end off today's program. People have been asking about this because, as you probably are aware, we started the tests back in May. And they were only supposed to be for 4 weeks, and we've continued them right until August the 4th. Of course, we can't continue doing tests forever. So we are going to take a short break of around 3 weeks, and then we're going to be back in September on 11835 kilohertz. So we're taking a little break of 3 weeks, partially because I have so many things to do. And the main thing, of course, is going through all the data that we have collected from these test transmissions, which is extremely valuable because it gives us a sense who's listening, where they're listening, and about the audience, who they are, what they do, are they regular listeners, are they DXers, etc., etc. So we're going to compile all that information, and then we'll be back in September. But this edition of the show that you're listening to right now, which is for our partner stations around the world, will continue as it always does. We're just stopping the shortwave for 3 weeks so we can collect, we can go through all the data that we have collected. So that's the good thing. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. We'll come back with a bit of a surprise, by the way, in September. But like I said, this show will continue, as it always does. Anyway, we're going to leave you right now with a little bit of Morrissey and a song called Ouija Board, Ouija Board. So on behalf of everyone that put the program together, I'm Keith Parent wishing you well, saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
Ouija Board, would you work for me? I have got to say hello. Ouija board, Ouija board, Ouija board, would you work for me? I have got to get through to a good friend. Well, she has now gone from this unhappy planet with all the carnivores. Ouija board, Ouija board, would you help me? Because I still do feel so horribly lonely. Would you Ouija board, would you Ouija board, would you help me? And I just can't find my place in this world. Well, she has now gone from this unhappy planet with all the carnivores and the destroyers. moving. No, I was not pushing that time.
This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 99.55 kHz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kHz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet. This is PCJ Radio.